welcome to the Great Books Podcast. Today we'll talk about the stories of Constance Fenimore Woolson. I'm your host, John J. Miller of National Review, and you're listening to a production of National Review. Our guest is Anne Boyd Rue, the author of several books, including Meg, Joe, Beth, Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters, as well as Constance Fenimore Woolson, Portrait of a Lady Novelist. She's also the editor of a collection of Woolson's stories published by the Library of America, and she's a two-time public scholar with the National Endowment for the Humanities. She joins us by Zoom as we record from Hillsdale College's campus radio station, WRFH in Michigan, and welcome to the Great Books Podcast.
Well, thank you so much, John. I appreciate you having me on.
Why are the stories of Constance Fenimore Woolson, when we collect them together, why are they a great book?
She's a writer whom I assume most of your listeners don't know. She was forgotten. So, of course, that always raises the question, why was she forgotten? It's complicated. We could talk about that, too. But if we go back and read her stories today, I think we find a kind of writer that maybe we're not used to in the 19th century. And she begs comparisons to Henry James and George Eliot. Those were two writers she was often compared to in her day. But she was really an important pioneer for regionalism. Regionalism is a very important genre in the 19th century. Regionalist stories introduced Americans to parts of the country that they didn't know much about. And it helped kind of solidify the sense of a nation made up of lots of different cultures and communities and peoples in the wake of the Civil War. And so she was one of the first to really emerge as a significant regionalist writer. And she was credited after she died with being one of the sort of forerunners to bring the American short story to a state of excellence that it really had not possessed earlier. So the short story really boomed after the Civil War. She was at the forefront of that.
We're going to talk about all of that. We're going to look at a few of the stories, the plots and the characters. We'll look at the biography of this interesting writer, discuss why she was forgotten, whether she's making a comeback now, her connection to the novelist Henry James, and a lot more. I want to start with her name, Constance Fenimore Woolson. I should say born 1840, died 1894. That middle name catches the eye, Constance Fenimore Woolson, and it brings to mind James Fenimore Cooper, the novelist who wrote Last of the Mohicans and other stories. Is there a connection?
Yes, there is. So James Fenimore Cooper was her mother's uncle, so he was her great uncle. Woolson was one of, oh gosh, I've forgotten how many, I want to say eight children, yes. Connie, as she was called by her family, was the only one who was given the middle name Fenimore. Fenimore was a family name, of course, on her mother's side, but it's really intriguing to me that she was the only one to get it because she was the one who was able to put it to good use. And when she started publishing in 1870, her first two stories, they were actually travel sketches, were published by Harper's, and I believe the other publication was Putnam's. And those are, you know, two very prominent literary magazines of the day. And those are, you know, the same month, I think it was October 1870, she's publishing these two pieces, her very first publications. It's pretty remarkable, at least that we know of. And there was this question for, you know, for the first year or two of her career, what she was going to be called. She appears as C.F. Woolson at times. And they really promoted her, or really encouraged her to use Fenimore. In fact, that was part of what got her in the door in the first place when she met these editors on a trip to New York. So it was something that she, you know, that she used to great effect. And there are some people who've compared her works to James Fenimore Cooper, see him as an important predecessor, at least in terms of her stories about the Great Lakes region, where you see her portraying more wild sort of frontier type country. And she picks up on some of the themes, but, you know, sort of reinvents them, you might say, for the later 19th century.
I guess that's a good brand name if you're in American literature. Right. You could do yeah. Worse than Fenimore.
And when she went to Europe, she found, you know, everywhere she went, people called her Constance Fenimore Cooper. And people still do call her that. It's funny, I was posting something on Instagram, and one of the options that came up when I typed up Constance Fenimore was Cooper. Frances Fenimore Cooper. So enough people have assumed that was her name, but it was just the middle name that she got from him.
Now, you mentioned regionalism and the Great Lakes region. Let's jump into an early story of hers. It's called Jeanette, written 1874. It's in your Library of America collection, as are all the stories we'll talk about in this show. It takes place on the, quote, bold island of Mackinac, unquote. And I'm attracted to it because, as a Michigander, I've been to Mackinac Island many times. But tell us, what is this story about? Who is Jeanette? What's the story?
Jeanette is, she's called a half-breed, I believe, in the story. So she was part Indian and French, right? So the, you know, the kind of communities that you would find up there in the mid-19th century, you would find a lot of sort of French, Native American families and, you know, mixings. And you see that in some of her other works as well, most notably her novel, Anne. But it's, she's a character, Jeanette is a character who's often depicted in sort of animal-like terms. She's wild, she's untamed, she's also extremely beautiful, and she captures the attention of this Puritan New Englander figure from Boston, a reverend who's there at the fort. So at the fort is where the narrator is living. She's the aunt of one of the soldiers there. And so she's describing the community and society, and she has taken an interest in this young woman, Jeanette, who's described as a girl. But as Jeanette says at the end of the story, I'm not a child. I'm a woman, and I'm going to make my own decisions about my future. And what we see in the story are these New Englanders kind of stepping in and trying to control her destiny and offer her a life of luxury and ease because the Reverend falls in love with her, wants to marry her. And to me, the most interesting part of the story is really the end, where Jeanette asserts her right to her own destiny and the fact that she's in love with Baptiste, who's, you know, a cousin, I think, and she's always been in love with him. So it's this kind of interesting twist at the end of the story. We see this actually in a number of Wilson stories. I mean, I picked that story for you to read because you're interested in a story set in Mackinac. I wouldn't consider it one of her best stories, but it is good for, I think, you know, thinking about some of the themes of her early writing. So we see this theme come up in other stories too that are set in the South, where she's encountering Minorcans, who are an ethnic minority who lived in Florida, and she's encountering a lot of freed slaves. And it's really interesting how she allows these characters, although they're clearly objectified and dehumanized by the other characters in the stories, the white characters from the North, they're patronized and things. And these white Northerners want to step in usually and educate them, make them more civilized and cultured. And in each case, we have these characters who refuse to be co-opted in this way and stand up and assert their right to live the way that they already live and that they're happier the way they are and kind of resist the civilizing influence, which I think is a really interesting theme in her fiction.
There's a lot of that in her stories, this meeting of cultures, this clash of cultures, mm-hmm. characters from mm-hmm. different backgrounds mm-hmm. coming together and working together, fighting each other, and so on.
Yeah, that is one of her main themes. And I think that is part of what makes her such an American writer. I mean, she wasn't writing about one particular class of people. She wasn't even writing about just one region. I mean, those early stories started in the Great Lakes. And she's often describing a sort of outsider-insider, you know, kind of dynamic, as we see usually fairly cultured city folk who may be from the East, but who may be from, you know, a place like Cleveland, which is where she grew up. And they're going out into the wilderness, encountering, you know, usually less educated people. She wrote some really interesting stories about the Zohr community in Ohio, which was a community of German separatists. You know, she enjoyed going there and spending her summers there. In fact, I didn't mention that. That's why she set so many works on Mackinac, was that she used to spend her summers there when she was growing up. She had that eye, that sort of, you know, that ability to observe and record details and really paint a picture of a place. You can really see these places as they were at the time in which she described them.
One of the things I liked about that story, Jeanette, is that when she describes Mackinac Island, it's a pretty good description of Mackinac Island today. If you're taking the ferry boat mm-hmm. over to the island, you could read her description. That's not bad in terms of the shape of the harbor, the placement of the fort, and so on. Let's move on to another one of these regional stories of hers. I enjoyed one called St. Clair Flats, and that takes place near Lake St. Clair, which is between Lake Erie and Lake Huron, with shores in Michigan, also Canada. What is that story about?
So that story is also set in an earlier time period. She gives us a specific date of 1855. And she often did this in her fiction about the Great Lakes, less so in her fiction about the South, when she moved south and started spending her summers there after 1873. But the stories about the Great Lakes, many of them are set during her childhood and adolescence, really. She was a great explorer with her father. They were out there on boats. She was a huge boater. She was, you know, she loved to row. And she was, you know, quite adventuresome for a young woman of that time. But St. Clair Flats includes so much incredible detail about the setting of these marshlands. And they're described in this kind of interesting way. So the sort of combination of detailed realism with a kind of romantic awe of the landscape and the character. This story is told in first person. It's told from a male perspective, which I think is quite interesting. Many of her stories were those early stories in particular. And that is something that has, I think, made her a little less classifiable by 20th century, early 21st century scholars, because she doesn't fit into a neat sort of camp as being, you know, a male realist or female regionalist. She was really working within both modes of realism and regionalism. And this is a great story to explore that, because she's thinking about how we mythologize the region, how we think about not just that region, but any remote region in America. It's this unspoiled land. There are very few inhabitants. These two men who are explorers, clearly from the East, are heading out there into the wilds, and, you know, they get lost. And it's actually, you know, you kind of have this sense of them being a kind of Lewis and Clark sort of expedition kind of thing, just on a very small scale. But they are looking for Waiting Samuel, who has a house on a little island, and they find him, and he's a religious zealot, and is waiting for Judgment Day, believes it's coming soon, worships the sun. But it's his wife who really takes center stage when they meet Roxana and they hear her sad story of losing a child and, you know, basically loving a man who's kind of living on another planet. So I think it's this really interesting story that is a good example of what I call her empathetic realism. And George Eliot wrote in this mode as well. And I don't think it's gotten nearly enough recognition or attention by scholars and readers, because we tend to think of realism as being more analytical, focused on characters, you know, what's going on in their heads, how they're interpreting everything around them, that kind of thing. Or it's social realism, right? Or it's things we're describing, social interactions and just sort of the social texture and fabric of American life at the time. But Woolson was writing what she saw clearly as realism. Every story, she says, was based in fact. But she's also showing us her characters' inner lives. You know, she's kind of helping us see the characters as real people. And in the stories, what we usually see, like you said, you have this clash of cultures, these people coming together, meeting up from very different walks of life. The potential for misunderstanding or lack of understanding is great. But what she shows us usually is a kind of rapprochement or ability to understand across these and respect each other across these divides. And they do that through empathy, by gaining a sort of understanding of these people's lives.
She moved around a lot, eventually left the Great Lakes region, went to Florida, and wrote a story called Rodman the Keeper. When I saw that title, I thought, well, clearly this is about a lighthouse keeper, but it turns out it's a keeper of the dead, we learn in the first line. So, first of all, What is a keeper of the dead, and what is this story about, and how is it an example of regionalism?
Yeah, so that story was written in 1875 after she visited the Confederate prison in Salisbury, North Carolina. And there, many Northern soldiers died, mostly of starvation, and they were buried in these, you know, in trenches and unmarked graves. And there's a national cemetery there, called a national cemetery because it was Northern troops. And the keeper then is the keeper of the cemetery. And he's writing down, there are some names out there, and he's trying to, you know, he's keeping a record of the people who died there. And he's also living among the dead, in the sense too that he is a Northern ex-soldier who doesn't see a future for himself in the present, right? So he's kind of resigned himself to this being this keeper of the names of the dead, of their memories. And he's confronted by, or he stumbles upon, I should say, an ex-Confederate soldier who's lost an arm and is very, very ill. There's no place suitable for him to live or suitable food. And so he ends up taking him in and caring for him. You know, there is clearly this rapprochement between ex-soldiers across the North-South divide. But the more interesting, I think, relationship or interaction is between John Rodman, the keeper of the cemetery, and the ex-Confederate soldier's cousin, Bettina, who still hangs on to her bitterness and doesn't appreciate him taking care of her cousin and that sort of thing. So that story, why is it regionalist? Well, it's really one of the best stories that we have that describes those tensions that persisted after the Civil War between North and South. It's not just about a particular region. It's really a very American story. Some people might call it regionalist just because it's set in a particular region in the South, a particular time, dealing with the issues of that region. But it's really much more than that. It's a very national story. That is the story of Wilson's that we're seeing anthologized more and more, being taught more and more, as we, you know, as we regain this sort of interest in the divisions, the things that divide us as a nation. I think we all know the country's very divided right now. And understanding the sources of that, I think this is a story that really allows us to think more about what it was like for people at that particular time.
I'm interested in this term regionalism, and sometimes I wonder, does it diminish the work in a sense? You know, if somebody sets a story in New York City, nobody calls that regionalist, right? Even though it's very maybe local in particular. And if you put it in, you know, Middle America, flyover country, Northern Florida, as with Rodman the Keeper, we call it regionalist. Is that a way of diminishing it, or should we think about this in a different way?
I think in a general sense, yes, the term regionalist or local color, which is maybe worse, has been used to diminish and also to indicate that this is work of minor stature because it's not really American. It's regionalist. It only applies to one particular region or part of the country. It's not national in character. And I think Wilson was very aware of that. And as I said, you know, many of her stories of this period are sort of operate on two levels. Like even St. Clair Flats, which is clearly set in a specific time and place, is really talking about America and the idea of America as having this sort of this kind of millennial forward progress, this idea of, you know, of a new day dawning, always pushing into the future. We see that happen in the story when at the end, main character goes back 15 years later after the war and discovers that they've built this canal through the marshlands and completely destroyed it. Right, the birds are gone. It's lost its charm. You know, so she's describing in a way, I think, America and in these sort of little pot and these pockets of experience. And these pockets of different landscapes around the country. And that's what makes her such an interesting writer, because other writers of the time were writing about one region, like Kate Chopin's writing about Louisiana, right? Sarah Ona Jewett is writing about Maine, and they get attached to a particular region. And I think that does in some ways limit their significance, unfortunately, although I think they're amazing writers, of course. But Wilson was writing about so many different regions, and in her novels as well. Her first novel, Anne, is set in like five different places. She's really very clearly trying to write an American novel with Anne, her first novel. But she was an American writer because she wrote about so many different places.
Your biography of her is subtitled Portrait of a Lady Novelist, and that term, Portrait of a Lady, of course, is the name of a novel by Henry James. You're clearly making a connection there with the title. What is the connection between Constance Fenimore Woolson and Henry James?
Well, I will say that that wasn't the original title, although I did come up with the title and choose it. It wasn't imposed upon me. I realized at some point that if I wanted that biography to be published by mainstream trade press, which I really was hoping I could do, because my first book was an academic book that sold for like $85 and nobody bought it, right? I believed that Constance Fenimore Woolson deserved to be more widely known. I felt very strongly about that. And so I knew I had, at some point, you know, I was going to have to tie her to Henry James. Because nobody knew who she was, right? And Henry James is in some ways her claim to posterity. It's why she has been remembered by a lot of people. If she's remembered at all, she's usually remembered as his friend whose death he grieved very deeply. And he had this sort of guilty complex about her for many, many years. And in stories, she kind of appears like in The Beast of the Jungle, Wings of the Dove. We see her, you know, we see these characters, these women who love unrequitedly and seem to kind of wither and die because of that unrequited love. And people have assumed, oh, that's Woolson. And, you know, so she's been described and remembered by his biographers, by all the novelists who've written about him, as this very tragic figure. And so feminist critics came along and saw her as a kind of victim of James's, that he neglected her as a writer. What I try to show in my biography is that their relationship was much more complex than that. Unfortunately, they destroyed their letters to each other, so we don't know as much as we would like to, but I think it's, first of all, very significant they destroyed their letters because she only had that arrangement with one other person in her life, her sister. And she said it was because she wanted to be free to speak her mind. Not so much because she was worried about posterity. I didn't think she'd think anybody would come along and want to be reading her letters. She was a very private person. But it was very much the practice. And James was doing this all the time, reading aloud letters that he received to other people. And she didn't want that. She wanted to kind of a sort of private space with him. And so they did have a very intimate friendship. He lived in her house for a while at various times, and they visited each other a lot. And it's very clear that, you know, they were considering collaborating on a play together. He'd never considered collaborating with another writer. So there's lots of interesting little clues that I talk about in the book that suggest the nature of their relationship, which I see as competitive as writers, but also supportive of each other in terms of this sort of quasi-familial relationship. Her niece, until the day she died in the 1950s, referred to him as Cousin Henry. So he was a very close member of her circle.
Constance Fenimore Woolson eventually went across the Atlantic, lived in Europe, lived in the same building as Henry James in Florence, and then she died in Venice in 1894, possibly by accident, probably a suicide. How did it end for her?
It seems very likely that it's very clear that she lost the will to live. Whether or not this was a premeditated suicide is hard to say. She didn't believe that suicide was an evil. She believed that people had the right to remove themselves from life when it became just too difficult. And her life had become very difficult. She suffered a lot from illness and depression. She'd just finished a novel, and so she was really broken down in spirit and body. She was very sick. And I think the most important thing to know is that she was very worried about being able to continue to support herself. So her writing had been a source of livelihood from the very beginning. It's why she started publishing at the age of 30 to support her and her mother after her father died. But the whole time she had her eye on greatness. She was always trying new things and trying to improve her writing. She wasn't just searching for popular acclaim, you know, writing a bestseller just for the money. The literary accolades were very important to her, and she received quite a bit of them. She was probably the most well-regarded female novelist from America in the late 19th century.
And I'd like to ask you about one more story by Constance Fenimore Woolson. This is a late story called In Sloane Street. It takes place in London. What's this story about, and why do you like it?
Well, it's a story about writers, and I guess that's why I like it so much. She wrote a number of works about women writers and artists, and they're quite complex and emotional. And many of them, well, most of them really, feature writers, women writers and artists who are frustrated, who've not been able to get the respect from the male literary elite that they desire. Even though Woolson did, she still always felt on this kind of uneven ground. She was always doing this dance around these male writers and critics. You know, and even in her friendship with James, it was complicated. And she sensed underneath their chivalry and gallantry at times this kind of, you know, this bedrock disbelief in women's abilities to create great art and literature. And the story really, you know, revolves around that, but also this more intimate personal question of what it means for a writer to be married to someone who's not a writer and has no interest in their work, no sort of meeting of the minds. And the way I talk about it in my biography is this is a story that I think comes out of her relationship with James. It's a theme that James wrote about, most notably in The Lesson of the Master. And, you know, he was also interested in this question, you know, what does it mean for a male writer to marry a woman who's, you know, who either knows nothing about literature or maybe a woman who does know everything about literature? Although we know today that Henry James was most likely gay, we don't know if Woolson knew that, what her feelings were exactly about him, but they were so close. I think this question of having a relationship of some sort, whether it was romantic or not, and some marriages weren't particularly romantic, were they? They were more sort of collaboratory. And we can see her sort of dancing around that issue in the story in such an interesting way through the character of Miss Gertrude Remington, who's clearly a suppressed writer. She loves literature. She adores her friend, who is this man who's a very great writer, but he has a vacuous, blonde-haired, blue-eyed, little wife who cares nothing for literature. And you can just feel Gertrude steaming throughout the story. It's a very funny story, too. It gives you a sense of Woolson's humor, I think.
She was very popular. She outsold Henry James while they both were alive. What happened to her reputation? She seems to have dropped off the map and maybe is now making a comeback, but explain the rise and fall and maybe return of Constance Fenimore Woolson.
Her first novel, Anne, did sell quite well, 57,000 copies. And to compare that to Henry James's The Portrait of a Lady, which was published at the same time, about in the same year, he sold 6,000, so almost one-tenth of what she sold. And that book led to an exclusive contract for her with Harper and Brothers. So she published all of her novels with them, serially in the magazine, then in hardcover, and then she also published all of her stories and travel sketches and things in their magazines. That was very rare at the time. That was very, that to have that sort of stability, she didn't have to go begging ever for a publisher. You know, she had one built in, and she had earlier, of course, but this was 10 years into her career, and that was quite a boon for her. And unfortunately, though, it kept her tied down when she could have maybe gone elsewhere and earned more money for her writing. She was very loyal to the Harpers. And when other writers, James included, were syndicating their work, she did not want to write for the syndicates. Those were the newspapers who were publishing novels serially and then syndicating them across the country in multiple newspapers. So, you know, they were making a lot of money from that. She declined to participate. So her high standards and her sense of loyalty, I think, hurt her. But then also she died at 53. You know, I'm 53. That seems awfully young to me now. And she didn't have the time to fully develop as a writer and solidify her significance. The other thing, you know, James lived a lot longer. He lived another 10 years and he wrote the New York editions, right? He re-edited all of, you know, his best works. And so he really he created a kind of canon for himself that did, you know, even though he wasn't popular in his day, of course, he has won the race for critical acclaim. But Wilson was forgotten along with many, many other women writers in the 19th century. Virtually to a one, they were suppressed and ignored and forgotten. Scholars have been doing tremendous work in the last, 30, 40 years. Feminist critics, you know, at the forefront of this, but lots of scholars have been involved in recovering all these really interesting writers that we can read in the periodicals of the time, and we see, oh, their novels were popular, they were acclaimed, what happened to them? And they were contributing really important works, I think, to the, you know, the conversations of American literature. The problem is they basically remain today pretty much secluded and shrouded in academic journals. That's where they're being written about. And most people don't have access to those. Most people don't know about them. So the perception of an American literary canon that is still predominantly male and white persists, despite the fact that dozens and dozens of women writers of many different ethnic backgrounds and races have been recovered. Lots of important writers, and they're just not making it out of academia into the wider conversation. So when I published my biography of Wilson with Norton, and I also edited a collection of her stories for them, but to see the reaction to her writing was the most gratifying thing.
What drew you to her particularly? There are a lot of women writers you could have written a biography about, I suppose, brought their work back into print. Why Constance Fenimore Wilson in particular?
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. I wrote my dissertation in graduate school on the first generation of American women writers to view themselves as serious artists. And that was a group of women, which included, you know, Emily Dickinson. Clearly, she was viewing herself as a very important, serious poet, even though she wasn't publishing. And there are many others, though, from the era who were publishing, and Wilson was one of them. Another one was Louisa May Alcott, whom I've written about, too. And she was publishing in The Atlantic monthly and other places and writing serious novels for adults before she became a children's writer. She had very high ambitions. I was really interested in, you know, American women writers' ambitions. Many of these writers from that post-Civil War period had their ambitions gratified to a great extent. Wilson was the one who stood out to me, though, as the most accomplished, the most dedicated, and the most successful. Her writings have just always really spoken to me as well. I think if you're going to write a biography of someone, you know, you're going to have this kind of intimate personal relationship with them for quite a few years.
And one more question then about Constance Fenimore Wilson. You've really helped bring her back into public attention. Why is she worth reading today in the 2020s? Why is this more than just a salvage operation, a worthy scholarly endeavor? Why should people go read the stories of Constance Fenimore Wilson right now?
Because I think they're such an incredible discovery. To read them is like going back in time and realizing that there was this tremendous writer that we've never heard of. And that is a really powerful feeling. And I think for me, when I first discovered her in graduate school, you know, I just felt like she felt like mine because other people weren't talking about her so much. Like I never read about her in a grad school class or anything, but there were this small group of scholars in the Constance Fenimore Wilson Society who were writing about her. And I got to know them at their conferences. The first one was at Mackinac, actually. That's when I went to Mackinac. But it's like he developed this personal relationship with her. All of the scholars working on Wolson feel that way. There's this intimacy to her writing that brings you so close. And to read stories set in these unfamiliar times and places and to feel that sort of empathy across time, I think that is the magic, the greatest magic of what literature can do.
Anne Boyd Rue, thanks so much for joining us and telling us all about the stories of Constance Fenimore Wilson.
Well, you're so welcome. Thank you for having me.
You've just listened to The Great Books Podcast, a production of National Review. Please subscribe to The Great Books Podcast and leave reviews of the show. That helps us keep this podcast going. Send me your ideas for future episodes. You can reach me through our website at heymiller.com on Twitter. My handle is at heymiller. Last of all, special thanks to all of you for listening. We'll be back next week with a new episode of The Great Books Podcast.